On Friday, U.S. equities continued their remarkable ascent, with the S&P 500 reaching an all-time record high this week. Hello, everyone. Good to be back with you this weekend with another edutainment-packed GoldSeek.com radio episode. Your host, Chris Walczak, here with you. Well, the show includes discussions with top economic advisors and the financial market headlines affecting your portfolio. First up, Cold War 2.0 could be the most likely outcome of the Ukraine-Russia showdown. That's according to Trends Research Institute Gerald Celente, the ideal diversion to direct attention away from the imploding global economy. Expect inflation to soar, sending gold higher, but this time it could be difficult to fight back with higher rates. Gerald is concerned by another war, the battle against chronic diseases, such as the alarming increase in type 2 diabetes and other lifestyle-related illnesses. The good news, though, is by removing refined foods and glucose-spiking foods from our diets, most chronic disease is manageable and maybe even reversible. Next up, Charles Goyette says careless foreign policy by the West has strengthened the ties between the BRIC nations, which are positioning themselves away from the U.S. dollar. The greenback will continue to lose reserve currency status at an alarming pace. Not good news for us here, but important information nonetheless to make contingency plans now. A new global conflict, though, could stem from unrest in the Ukraine area. Plus, the Argentine currency crisis represents an early warning mechanism, giving us valuable time to prepare for the onset of inflation. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies loomed over the gold market on a stealth U.S. dollar rally on the heels of hawkish Fed meeting minutes. The news caused a sea change in sentiment, at least in the near term. So by Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was off only $23, finishing at $12.81 an ounce, still higher for the year by about 5%. Silver lost only 15 cents, ending at $19.40. Palladium was down $5.75, finishing at $8.88 on continued supply disruption concerns between the West and Russia, the world's largest supplier. And platinum futures were off about 36, finishing at $14.22 an ounce on the NYMEX. West Texas Intermediate crude was down nearly $4, finishing at $93.40 per barrel. Well, gold rebounded on Friday following comments from Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen at the Kansas City Fed's annual economics conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. She noted slack remaining in the labor market, which could leave room for further monetary stimulus effort. Dr. Yellen discussed the latest Fed's Open Market Committee meeting minutes, citing underutilization of labor resources. The Labor Department also announced initial claims fell by 14,000, though, to 298,000 this week. In addition, policymakers are growing a bit more concerned about the possibility of higher rates. That, according to the Fed meeting minutes, a considerable shift in sentiment regarding rate hikes is apparent. In addition, the Fed Chair Janet Yellen said the economy is closer, though, to the goals of full employment and stable inflation. The news helped lead the U.S. dollar out of the doldrums, which soared this week, catching even yours truly off guard. Nevertheless, one top money manager who handles $220 million of assets, by talking down inflation expectations, he expects gold to remain cheap in the near term, which further benefits the Fed-fomented stock market rally. In addition, the chief economist at Oppenheimer Funds in New York, who manages $250 billion in assets, noted that the economic conditions remain somewhat tame, so this would also be a positive for the precious metals. Turning to geopolitical news, over 300 trucks from Russia entered Ukraine without a Red Cross escort through a checkpoint, according to a Bloomberg reporter. Valentine Nalivachenko, the head of Ukraine Security Council, announced that Russia was invading covertly. These reports have not been confirmed. We'll be keeping a close eye on the situation next week. Precious metals bottom line. Well, a mea culpa is required this week. My call for a dollar decline. The Fed clearly caught the bears off guard with hawkish comments. So even with geopolitical instability, it looks like the Fed really has the biggest monetary bazooka around. This theme is expected to persist, I think, for the next few weeks, and a retest of the reaction lows is now most likely. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors piled into shares despite hawkish comments from the Fed as investors reallocated global funds into the perceived relative safety of domestic shares. Plus, investors took comfort in Dr. Yellen's comments at the annual Jackson Hole meeting. For the week, the Dow added about 340 points, finishing at over 17,000. The S&P 500 was up, though, 33 points, wrapping up at 1988, touching a new all-time record this week and with an earshot of that 2,000-point benchmark, while the NASDAQ added 94, also at highest point in about 14 years, finishing at 4,464. Meanwhile, investors turned to equities and the U.S. dollar this week on continued news of geopolitical unrest. Investors in Europe, Asia, and the Southern Hemisphere continue to plow funds into U.S. shares as the safe haven of last resort. Plus, momentum tends to feed upon itself as money managers clamor in the footsteps of their comrades, causing a self-perpetuating stampede. Most traders expect the remarkable uptrend to persist given the surprising increase in corporate profitability in the second quarter of the year. There have been pockets of improvement in the economy, such as in labor and manufacturing. Investors have parked record levels of capital in domestic equities, ETFs, with net inflows of $7 billion as of this week, according to a Lipper analytical report. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our favorite seven-component sentiment index remains in the fearful category despite the new record highs in the S&P 500. Now, this is generally a big positive sign from a contrarian perspective. It's indicative of market resiliency. For this week's stock market candidates and all of next week's forecast, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Charles Goyette and Gerald Celente. We'd really like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Charles Goyette penned The Dollar Meltdown, a New York Times bestseller, as well as his latest Red and Blue and Broke All Over, Restoring America's Free Economy. Welcome back, Charles Goyette.
Chris, always great to speak with you.
Well, wanted to address, if we could, some of the issues facing investors today. I mean, there's a lot on the plate, and maybe we could begin with the Ukraine-Russia drama. You know, the West threatening to place sanctions on Russia regarding the tensions there between this breadbasket, if you will, and energy hotspot in Eurasia. I'd like to know what your thoughts are and just how things might get out of hand here.
You know, Chris, this is a true disaster. I mean, this, because none of this had to happen. I mean, this is all so unnecessary. We know that the United States has spent $5 billion trying to subvert the government there, that the United States really was behind what amounted to a coup in Ukraine earlier this year. And it's not that anybody in making this charge is defending the prior government. They're all a bunch of thugs as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, when you have the Assistant Secretary of the State of the United States caught on the telephone saying, you know, when we pull this string, we pull that string, we want Yats in charge. Yats is our guy. And then all of a sudden the government is toppled. After we've spent $5 billion to that end, the government is toppled and Yats is installed. I mean, you've got some pretty good evidence that the invisible hand of the United States is behind it. You know, Chris, I know we don't want to get into a lot of specific details, but I will tell you what's important to me. It was really a wonderful thing when the Cold War ended.
Yeah.
The American people had been bled dry by this thing. The people of Eastern Europe had certainly been occupied, and the Russian people had been bled dry by it. And finally, it came to an end, and it came to an end without a shot being fired. After all those years of standoff and, you know, tens of thousands, this is not an exaggeration, tens of thousands of nuclear warheads pointing at one another, bristling, ready to go at a moment's notice, and it ended without a shot being fired. We were so fortunate to get that deal, and part of the deal was that at the time, Gorbachev said, look, we'll get out of East Germany. They didn't have to. They were financially broke, but even a bankrupt could do a lot of damage. I mean, they still had who knows how many tanks and 300,000 troops in East Germany, and they said, we will pull out from East Germany. We will not stand in the way. Anybody that knows Russian history knows that they have, whether you like it or not, they have a good reason to have wanted Germany divided, and that reason was fear. You know, from a couple of invasions over the prior 100 years.
Right.
But in any event, they decided that they told our Secretary of State in Moscow, they told James Baker, we won't stand in the way. And in fact, we won't even object if you want to bring Germany into NATO. We don't care. Just don't bring NATO onto our border. Don't expand NATO. And James Baker, no dummy, he said, not an inch, not an inch to the east. And then the evil empire came down, and Russia retreated within its borders where it belonged. And Germany was reunited as it should have been, and it fell to Bill Clinton to want to show how tough he was in an election campaign. This is what American politicians do. He wanted to be the toughest kid on the block, and so he made it his business to expand NATO. And we have seen over, and we saw in the Georgia, South Ossetia incident a couple of years ago that this is Russia's line in the sand. They do not want an expansionist military state on their borders, including NATO. And having been invaded from Ukraine two or three times, from the era of Napoleon to twice by Germany, having been invaded through Ukraine, the flat plains of Ukraine, they don't want an American militarized police state or military state on their border. And so none of this had to happen. Why is it in our interest? What do we care? So this is the mess that we've left with. We've instigated a coup there. We've insisted, creating a NATO expansionist NATO in Europe, despite our promise to the contrary, a promise that left the world in a wonderful state of peace, so that we should have had a peace dividend, and instead we've had nothing but war.
No, exactly. And, you know, that was a very eloquent, thorough analysis. And I would just add that having just spoken with Gerald Celente on the same topic, he brought up the expansion of the International Monetary Fund could be the impetus behind this drive to expand the forces.
Well, let's explain what's really going on, because the International Monetary Fund is nothing but a way to launder money from the American taxpayers and the British taxpayers and others too. But it's always been primarily American taxpayers get laundered. And the senator from Florida, whose name escapes me, that everybody thinks would be just a wonderful candidate for the presidency, writes an article in the Wall Street Journal, says let's create a Ukrainian currency board. In other words, let's milk the American taxpayers. Let's get the American taxpayers to borrow money from places like China. Oh, and borrow money from places like Russia. Russia is also a creditor of the United States Treasury to prop up the failing Ukrainian currency. In other words, milk the American taxpayer to do what the Ukrainian people won't do for themselves. And so, you know, you got this kind of move going on. You've got John Kerry gets off an airplane in Kiev and he waves around $1 billion. This is, and Barack Obama has more where this comes from. Well, Barack Obama doesn't have that kind of money. So he means money from the American taxpayers. But where does that money go? when the money goes to Ukraine, do you think it makes daily life for the people in Ukraine better? No. So the little children of America are indebted for the rest of their lives to pay back creditors in China or places like Russia, to give money to the government in Ukraine so that it can pay back banks that have loaned money foolishly to Ukraine. One of the biggest, I think it's Fidelity, has got is $7 billion worth of Ukrainian bonds in their portfolio. Well, shame on them. Ukraine has defaulted on IMF loans twice in the last few years. So if they bought a bunch of bad bonds, too bad for them.
Before we shift gears here, I would like your thoughts as to whether or not this is leading to something greater. We're all aware by now, all the listeners of this show, that there are nefarious interests behind the scenes, and I'm putting it euphemistically, pulling the strings here. Is this just a coincidence that this is occurring right now in Ukraine, or is there a master plan?
Well, I think a lot of different interests have a lot of different master plans, and they don't necessarily all come together and work the way they intend. But you know, clearly there are warmongers and war profiteers that, you know, think, well, this is good. You know, we'll sell a lot of munitions and we'll fund a lot of countries and we'll put more troops, in Europe, more weaponry in Europe. We'll get the American people to fund more weaponry and spread, so the merchants of death are clearly behind it. And, you know, they calm themselves. They tranquilize themselves like, you know, it's just a defensive measure and nothing will ever get out of hand. Oh, nothing will ever get out of hand, except every time they do this, something gets out of hand. So I think they're playing a very dangerous game. They do not understand Putin's motives. You know, you have to have read a little history to understand Putin's motives, and dilettantes like John McCain clearly haven't. So, the American public is susceptible to being propagandized that, you know, that Vladimir Putin is the new Hitler and that he's intent on taking over the world and he must be stopped now because he didn't want us in Crimea and because the people in eastern Ukraine voted to separate themselves from the West. Well, we'd have voted to separate ourselves too if we'd, you know, the former prime minister of Ukraine, after she got out of prison when she's running for election in the latest go-around, says, you know, that she wanted to nuke about 8 million Russians in Ukraine. I mean, these people are sick, but nobody is sicker than the United States trying to foment war there. So, you know, there are many interests. There are bank interests, there are financial interests that, you know, that very, very much like this deal of, you know, they can get high return on bonds. Oh, your mom and dad in their retirement can't get a decent return at the bank thanks to Fed policy, but these can get a high return on their Ukrainian government bonds. Who would do that? Somebody politically connected, knowing full well that if Ukraine defaults, that the International Monetary Fund will step in with laundered American money to bail them out. So there are war profiteers, there are financial interests, there are energy interests, and so on. You know, think the United States should rule the world and everything would be fine, and the people everywhere, you know, want to be ordered about by the American embassy in their country. Look how well that's worked out.
So unfortunate, because that's the prevailing zeitgeist. This is what really perturbs us, the few of us, I guess, remaining who actually delve into the minutiae. You talk about, you know, Ukraine, and there is some conjecture here that we might see something much greater. Is this essentially another Cold War, or could this turn into something worse?
I'm afraid, actually, Chris, I'm afraid it could turn into something worse. I think this is one of the real danger spots, and it has always struck me that, you know, that the things break out in places where people don't expect them. And, you know, if we'd asked, you know, a year ago, you know, what would be the instigation of a new shooting war in the world, you might have looked to the Senkaku Islands, or you might have looked to the Middle East, you might have looked to Syria and places like that. But I think this is really the single most dangerous spot in the world and the single most dangerous policy. It is certainly at this point a Cold War, and it could very easily, and a lot of people would be clearly satisfied if it were to become a hot war. All we can hope is that the normal market forces that tend to dampen these extravagant, violent periods called wars, that the market forces that would tend to pacify the standoff are allowed to work. I mean, you know, there are a lot of players in Germany that don't like it. There are, you know, there are economic interests all throughout Europe that are not happy with it. Right now, they're under the influence of the American hegemon. A lot of political leaders around the world continue to play, step and fetch it to Uncle Sam. And yet their own economic interest is not to let this thing get out of control and to step it down. So if you see broad resistance to American policy from Europe, that's a very, very good thing. A European war, a broken down Russia, by the way. People are concerned about, broken down states in Eastern Europe and nuclear warheads around the world and so on. Believe me, a broken down Russia is in nobody's interest. But yet the very same people that fomented this, National Endowment for Democracy coup in Ukraine have a bill before the United States Senate to do the same thing in Russia, to, start spending billions and billions of dollars destabilizing Russia. How smart is this? Whose interest? I mean, you look at the economic turmoil in Germany during the Weimar Republic. Does anybody really think that a broken broken German middle class would somehow be a key to tranquility and lubricate social relationships and so on among the German people? Because that's what they engineered. They paid their penny and they sure got what they bought. They got a radicalized Germany, a radicalized German people, the ashes of resentment of a destroyed economy and a destroyed middle class, and now they want to implement the same game in places like Russia.
We just forget our history, because name a war that Russia, or China for that matter, their allies and neighbors, have really lost. I'm talking about a military conflict. I guess you could argue, you would look at the Russo-Japan conflict, but for the most part, these are chess players, and they really strategize 5, 10, 15 years out. We're lucky if we can get our legislators, I think, to look forward 5, 10 weeks forward, with the exception of Dr. Ron Paul.
Well, how many countries, if you believe that Putin is the new Hitler and he's bent on expansionism and taking over Europe, how many countries has he invaded? Oh, by the way, before you answer the question, you can't say he invaded Ukraine. He didn't do that. There was an election in the East. Crimeans voted to secede. How many countries has he invaded, and how many countries has the United States bombed, strafed, or invaded during the 15 or so years that Putin's been in power?
Exactly. That's just the litmus test. All right, let's shift off the geopolitical and move into the geoeconomic and talk a bit about what this all means for the typical investor. We have seen oil pull back. We've also seen the dollar under some pressure. It's been sitting there for years. It just can't seem to find its footing. What's the big strategy here? What should folks be thinking about for their portfolios?
Well, clearly the result of all of this is long-term destructive for the dollar, but it's not even long-term anymore. I mean, virtually everything that you see on the world stage in all of these events is log rolling the end of the dollar reserve standard. And it's happening. Chris, you and I have talked about this kind of stuff for years. I've watched this virtually all of my life, all of my adult life anyway. And so to people like ourselves that watch this stuff closely, things are really picking up speed now. And so with respect, for example, to Russia, we have, talk about strange bedfellows, talk about squaring the circle. We have driven Russia into China's arms. They've got the $400 billion natural gas deal. They are moving ahead on their bilateral currency arrangement to settle. They settle 75% of their trades in dollars. Why should they?
No, exactly. And not to mention, they're also side deals with Iran, of course, to eliminate that, right, dollar hegemony and the petrodollar arrangement, more of a regional yuan, where that becomes the new de facto currency. So, I mean, a lot on the table there.
It's going on everywhere. I mean, you got the BRIC nations getting together to form their little equivalent of the IMF, more power to them. You know, let them fund themselves instead of, you know, laundered American taxpayer money used to fund their problems or their broken economy.
Now, that brings up another issue here. You talk about the BRIC nations. We think of Brazil. Let's talk about Argentina. Now, Argentina, again, facing, I don't want to call it hyperinflation, but galloping inflation. Folks who turned their currency into gold, of course, have had spectacular returns in a very brief period of time. Is this a petri dish for what we should expect in the West, in our hemisphere?
Because it's a classic laboratory experiment. You know, how many times do the poor people in Argentina need to live through this event? Yeah, I mean, this is the end game of socialized economies and socialized monetary policy. It's the end game of fiat money. And apparently they've had that, you know, generally when a nation goes through a catastrophe like this, they learn their lesson, and usually it stays learned for at least a generation or so. I mean, you know, you could have gone to the German people in 1950 and 60 and 70. One of the reasons they had such a strong currency is they had learned a lesson about inflation in the 1920s. And they had, you know, kind of a national memory of it. It was on, you know, all of the parents' lips when they raised their kids, and their kids learned it. And so that generally these lessons last for at least a generation or two. But in Argentina, apparently, I guess the lesson hasn't taken. So these countries, Venezuela and Argentina, are great laboratory experiments in if we need to see it again. I don't know how many times we need to see the bankruptcy of, you know, these socialist monetary policies in action before we learn for ourselves. And it's always struck me as peculiar that while so much of the rest of the world is actually striking out for prosperity, other nations are trying to make their countries safe havens for foreign investors. You know, we are going quite the opposite direction. You're driving people out of our currency, doing exactly what we have seen in country after country after country that makes us all poorer. I guess the only hope for the American people is for the ones who insulate themselves from the nationalized, the collective, or the corporate calamity of our monetary and fiscal authorities.
I really think it's a function of the idea that we're prosperous, we're wealthy, you know, but unfortunately that has to come from somewhere. And as you said earlier, the cost is going to be shouldered by our progeny for who knows how long. It's just one of many of the social costs, but I really like that point. You know, capitalism is so important. It has such an awful moniker, doesn't it, today? You don't hear anybody saying, well, China has embraced capitalism and look what a wonder this pseudo-communist capitalist society, what it has done. What you hear is the disparaging of our system, which 100, 120 years ago reminds me of China and much of Asia.
Just your thought about capitalism. I even have learned to abhor the word because it conjures up in people's minds, you know, a caricature. It conjures up in people's minds. It's really this top hat and the monocle and the, you know, the spats and the cane, you know. So what the image, of course, is J. Pierpont Morgan and crony capitalists. You know, that's what people believe capitalism is. It's crony capitalism. And, of course, it's the furthest thing. So we've got our work cut out for us educating the people. I've decided not to use the term capitalism myself just because you're swimming against the tide of public consciousness. So I try to talk about, you know, a free economy and economic freedom and so on and so forth. But you're right. I mean, it's a caricature of capitalism that people have in their mind, and they find it distasteful. Well, of course it is. Crony capitalism is distasteful to everybody who see, and the American people have seen it writ large now with the bailout of the banksters and the impoverishment of the people.
Charles Goya, tell our listeners today how they can find out more about everything you're working on.
Well, sure. CharlesGoyette.com, CharlesGoyette.com. I do a monthly newsletter, the Freedom and Prosperity Letter, that can be found there, along with my books and so on and so forth. The Freedom and Prosperity Letter, it's a monthly newsletter. We've priced it so that it can be very affordable. Published by Weiss Research, one of the largest financial publishers in the country, and you can find out more at CharlesGoyette.com.
But you also are doing radio, as I understand.
Well, I don't know when our conversation will run, but we actually did this interview on the 79th birthday of Congressman Ron Paul. What a great contribution he's made to the American political debate, and how it's amazing how many people he's awakened. And yes, our weekly podcast is available at moneyandmarkets.com. Every week, every Friday, we put up a new podcast, a chance to talk about the same issues that you listen to with Chris and his guests.
Well, I certainly share your sentiments with regard to Dr. Paul. He's just been great to us here, a friend of the show. But more importantly, I think, has this crusade, if you will, to enlighten America and our legislators to the errors of this central banking system that we've set up and just what that will mean to this country going forward. So, Charles Goyette, we always appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Chris, always great to speak with you.
Well, Gerald Celente is director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal with hard-hitting, in-depth analysis of economic, sociopolitical, and cultural trends. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
I thought we could start off with your latest Trends Journal edition. You know, I have a copy here on the desktop. Geopolitical concerns, you know, are high on the list. Give us an idea whether or not you think investors might be a bit complacent. You know, every equities sell-off we've seen has been met with surprising buying strength. Are investors overlooking the big picture here?
You know what's going on? If you follow the mainstream news, the business news, it's almost comical. Stocks are down because of geopolitical uncertainty. Stocks are up because of easing of geopolitical uncertainty. And it's just every day they keep down, up. Either they're overblowing it or they're downplaying it. But they're really not overblowing it at all, because the world is teetering on war the way we see it. What's going on in Ukraine, this has been a propaganda effort by the United States, the likes of which I've never seen in my lifetime, because after all, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda. And I'm just reading President Obama's March 28, 2011 speech on why we have to overthrow the Gaddafi government. So propaganda has been going on there a long time. But what's going on in Ukraine is extremely important, because this is lining up to be Cold War 2.0. And why anybody would consider taking on the Russians is beyond my comprehension. I mean, after all, Napoleon couldn't pull it off. Hitler launched the largest, most massive military offensive in world history, and he couldn't pull it off against the Russians. Do you think the United States and NATO can, when they look what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan? Oh, and I mentioned Libya. That's up for grabs, too. So when I'm saying propaganda, I mean this without any hesitation at all. I'm going to give you an example. First of all, remember that airplane that was shot down over Ukraine? Have you seen any proof of who did it? Not a piece. Have you seen any proof of the Russians coming out, the Ukraine government's coming out and saying a Russian convoy came into Ukraine territory and we attacked it and we blew it up? Have you seen any photos of it? All they're doing is they're selling propaganda about the Russian troops on the borders, on and on and on, without showing one piece of evidence. Nothing. And what they're doing is they're putting out sound bites so the American public can find its enemy very easily, and the enemy has become Russia. Number two, what's going on in the Middle East, particularly with the Israel destruction of Gaza? And all of a sudden, you can't say anything. I could save it for somebody else. Having said that, what's going on over there with the mass destruction is leading to war, because I have a fear that that's going to go into Lebanon. If that does, and then you go in what's going on into Syria, and that's up for grabs, and now you're seeing what's going on with the United States back engaged, by the way, into Iraq. You have a total destabilization of that area. Now, of course, what's going on in Ukraine, and that situation is only getting worse. So, going back to your initial question, are the people overlooking the geopolitical concerns that we are facing? And I believe, yes, they are. because this game could change overnight. It's so easy to take people to war. You have the Trends Journal. I did a story in it about how easy it was for America to be led into the Afghan war. And I began it by saying words to the effect, it was Bush's speeches of the evening of 9/11 and 9 days later in his address to the nation. And I began it by saying only a madman would speak these words and only people struck with terror would believe them. And I broke apart his speech. Not one piece of evidence, nothing that took us to war against Afghanistan, the longest war in American history. I'm saying that because, as you can see the propaganda being dealt out, you can see how little people really pay attention to the facts of the news rather than what's being fed through the government and through the media, how easy it is to go to war. And when all else fails, they take you to war, and the global economy is failing. All you have to do is look at oil prices. The reason oil prices have been down, now they're down to 14-month lows, Brent crude, why are they going so low? Because demand is so off. Look at the housing bubble that has burst in China. 67 out of 70 cities, housing prices are down. Housing prices are falling in London. The bubble is bursting everywhere. So to get your mind off things, a nice war really is a good diversion.
You really covered a lot of interesting bases there. Firstly, this idea, we saw that Napoleon fail and many others. Russia, you might even say, is a nation that's never truly been defeated, although people point to the Cold War. But, you know, we forget about their neighbors, China. The name itself, Qin, China, actually, as you know, derives from the word wall. And the walls were there to keep out invaders, invading forces. You know, when we look at this, you have two neighbors there that are the two undefeated countries of the world. And, you know, they have quite a long history, too. Quite a substantial military in each country. So why would we even consider antagonizing both countries, neither of which we should be embracing them as allies, but yet we're doing the opposite? We forget how many folks who were defeated there. Let's start with Alexander the Great. He tried to get into Persia. He failed. Many folks would argue that the British Empire failed in Persia, bankrupted Russia. And now we have the hubris to march in there and think that we can accomplish the impossible, all while we're bankrupting this country. Tell us more.
Well, you really summed it up. And again, it's who are the we? The we aren't us. They happen to be in charge of the government. And I want to make the connections. When you talk about Ukraine, anybody could do this. They could go to YouTube, type in Victoria Nuland, N-U-L-A-N-D. And Victoria Nuland happens to be the Assistant Secretary of State. Her husband is Robert Kagan, one of the prime neocons. Put in December 13th, 2013. And there she is at the National Press Club. And you know who her sponsors are? Exxon and Chevron. Yeah, and here she is giving a speech about her trip to Ukraine. It's a third trip in 5 weeks. And she's going on and on and on about how the path of Ukraine is European. And that was going to require immediate steps to de-escalate the security situation and immediate political steps to end the crisis and get Ukraine back into a conversation with Europe and with the International Monetary Fund. Follow the money. And then I looked it up, and Chevron just cut a $10 billion deal to do hydrofracking in Ukraine. Oh, and I forgot this little side point. There's a energy company in Ukraine, the largest one, Burisma Energy, and they appointed someone to the board of directors. It's the largest energy company in Ukraine. Do you know who it is? Joseph Biden's son, Hunter Biden. And they also appointed, another fellow who is Christopher Hines of the Hines Fortune and John Kerry's stepson, Devon Archer. His partner, Christopher Hines' business partner, Devon Archer, was also appointed to Burisma Energy. I mean, who are these people kidding?
You have the West that wants to embrace Ukraine for its natural resources. And, of course, Russia does not want to let go of its key resource regarding energy, all different types of energy, as well as the breadbasket, I'm sure you'd agree, of Eurasia. Essentially, you know, you have the West saying, oh, they need to be free so our companies can exploit the nation. And you have Russia that's a former Soviet bloc country. This is a strategic resource for us.
Would be like if we had problems with Mexico or Canada and Russia coming in here and telling us what we should do. Here, I want to read this to you. A new deal with the IMF would also send a positive signal to private markets. This is Victoria Nuland at the National Press Club on December 13, 2013, and would increase foreign direct investment that is so urgently needed in Ukraine. Hey, what are you doing talking about what's going they need? You're supposed to be working for us, but I digress. Signing the association agreement with the EU would also put Ukraine on a path to strengthening that sort of stable, quote, and predictable business environment that investors require. There is no other path that would bring Ukraine back to long-term stability and economic growth. And it's the United States, and she's also on audio tape with the Ukraine ambassador, American ambassador to the Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, planning the overthrow of the Yanukovych government.
If they pull us into a global conflict here, which I suspect the stage is being set.
It is being set. Chris, you're a student of history. We are now 100 years away from the First World War. The war to end all wars, the so-called Great War, a war that by every historian's knowledge was totally avoidable, and it destroyed Europe. Europe never regained from it. It was blossoming in truly a new age.
Exactly. And, you know, it set the stage, as John Maynard Keynes pointed out in his treatise, for the next most even more horrible war. And it almost feels like a purge. If people could step back from their daily lives and imagine that they were born into privilege, never had to work a job in their lives, the rest of us would look like sheep. We're just sheeple. Heaven forbid if some of those sheep start to look like wool. You know, we've got to clear the herd a little bit. And nothing clears better and makes profits for the elite better than wars. They profit on both sides of the conflict, don't they?
But this is different. This is the war that when they asked Albert Einstein, how will the Third World War be fought?
I don't know, but the next one will be with sticks and stones.
You got it. Yeah. Yeah, no. That's it. This is a war of weapons of mass destruction. This is you know how they always say generals fight the last war? This is different. This isn't going to be tanks and planes. It'll be high-speed missiles and biological warfare and nuclear. And that's why at all costs we need to avoid war. And as I mentioned, it's so easy to go into it.
And this is coming from a martial arts practitioner.
No, I'm not a pacifist at all. I'm a close combat practitioner. You know, and I had my own school for many years. You know, but I believe in self-defense. I don't believe in attacking a country that's not a threat. I will attack the attacker.
I try to tell this to friends and family, and don't you remember why the world looked up to the United States? It wasn't just that we were it wasn't just the Statue of Liberty motto. It was the fact that we were that type of a country. We were there trying to police things and keep the status quo. You know, another interesting thing here in the Trends Journal, and you know, this maybe isn't something that all of our audience will be keen to hear, but I think it's really important for every stage of life, and that's our health. And you've always brought up this topic. And it's one I think that everyone could use, you know, even physicians can use help with sometimes. What I wanted to talk about was this idea about you're delving into the stats on what we're eating and the salt, sugar, additives, and it's just not necessary. I mean, you don't have to be independently wealthy to eat a healthy diet. Please tell us more.
Again, what we did with this Trends Journal, the feature story was don't blame Obamacare, blame I don't care. And, you know, we do have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. And it could be even more expensive. It's not going to make any difference as long as people keep eating what they eat and keep doing what they do. We're the most obese nation in the world. I mean, I never remember as a kid seeing people ride down supermarket aisles in cars, little electric cars, because they're too obese to walk. I mean, that's a phenomenon that we've never seen. Type 2 diabetes didn't exist when I was a kid, and now how many children have it?
It's diabetes. You know, my very favorite physician, Dr. Mark Hyman, he says half of us are either diabetic or we are pre-diabetic or we're on the road to diabetes. And it doesn't have to be the case. And, you know, I've just seen miracle after miracle where folks have simply cut the sugar out of their diet. Condiments, mostly filled with sugar. You know, little things like tomato sauces. We can make a difference without having to turn to insulin-related medicines that cause a lot of trouble in people's lives. Tell us more.
Hit on a lot of it because you keep taking it further. And it's with the people, they don't care what they look like, and they don't care how they dress. Again, when I remember as a young guy flying, you know, people got, you know, dressed when they got on an airplane. Now it's a flying circus.
Yeah, yep.
And then when I remember as a young guy in business going into a restaurant without a jacket, and they wouldn't let me in. Conversations going on four tables away. You hear people screaming. So what I'm saying is it's a decline in many different ways. So people ask me, well, how could things change? And to me, the way they're going to change is when people find the courage, the dignity, the self-respect, the integrity, and the passion to be the best that they can be. And then when you get to those levels or you feel you keep working, it's a never-ending life experience, you keep trying to get better at everything that you do, that's when things change because you don't accept whether it's low-quality food, low-quality relationships, or low-quality politicians. It's all connected. And right now, we are at the lowest common denominator. Look at the numbers when the American people, look how they look at Congress and the presidency. There's a total lack of, a huge lack of respect. And then you listen to their language of the politicians.
And, you know, before we change topics here, I'd like to add that what Dr. Mark is always pointing to is that this is really an inflammation battle. Type 2 diabetes, as you brought up, and so many other diseases. And, you know, he worked in an emergency room, and he said, for many years, and he said, you know, the one thing we really have right in the medical community is if you're in an accident and you've had trauma or you're having a cardiac arrest or, you know, something along these lines, the emergency room, wow, do we have that right? We will fix you up, and more than likely you'll be on your merry way, and we can rehabilitate you. But where we've got it wrong is chronic illness, because what we don't realize is I'm a man of 45 years. It took me 45 years to get into the shape I'm in right now. I'm not going to clean that mess up in 4 or 5 weeks or even 4 or 5 months. It might take 4 or 5 years of lifestyle change. And that might be cutting out the fast food, the fries, the milkshakes, the tomato sauces, and, you know, go back to organic sauces, things of this nature. But you can reduce the inflammation, which is at the root of almost all chronic disease, by simply getting the sugar out of your diet.
The first book I worked on was Natural Healing back in the mid-1980s. I have an honorary doctorate degree in integrative medicine from the National University of Health Sciences. So I've been on this for a lot of years. My former wife was literally dying from colitis. You're talking about chronic degenerative diseases. And they were going to remove her colon, you know, a big chunk of it, and other things that aren't very nice to talk about on the radio. And I went on the crusade. This is in the late 70s when people weren't talking about this stuff, to try to save her life. And I did. And we found in those days with chiropractors, they were way ahead of the curve. And that's how I worked on Natural Healing. She was got totally healed. And they had her on prednisone and all these other drugs. And all they do is stop the symptoms. There's no allotropic drug on the market that cures a chronic degenerative disease, period, paragraph. And so that's why I'm very much into this, and I try to live it as well. So everything I buy, I don't buy corporate food. I stay away from it as much as I can, I should say. I rarely go into a so-called supermarket. I try to buy everything I can organic, and like you said, it's not really, yes, organic does cost more, but even if you're not buying organic and you're eating healthy, you can eat, if you're buying burgers at McDonald's and you're drinking soda, you know, you could afford the same alternatives for a healthy food. And again, I stopped drinking soda, and now I'm in my late 60s.
You can take small steps. No one expects you to change everything overnight. For instance, as you say, you know, cut out the fast food, start cooking at home. And that is, we have to take our health into our own hands and stop looking for that magic pill. Because, you know, as I mentioned before, it takes decades to get into this shape and it can take years to pull yourself out, but it's doable and it doesn't come from an insulin injection. All that's going to do is increase your insulin resistance over the long term and lower your quality of living.
See, it all ties in because what you just said is it takes time and it takes work. And you keep taking that concept and you bring it into economics and social as well.
Excellent, yes.
So it's all tied together. Discipline, and there's nobody on a white horse to save the day. You're it, and it's not politician, so don't look for the answers with them. Look for the answers within yourself.
I read an interesting article this week at one of my favorite web blogs, and it was from an author who was just disgusted with what he was seeing in the workplace. And he said, you know, I hire many folks, but I wanted to write this article to tell you how, you know, I had nothing, like everyone of my generation. He said, this isn't a story of how, oh, I'm a great guy who pulled myself up. You know, a few decades ago, we all worked odd jobs. I mean, I could name 100 jobs I've had, and so could you. And he said, but today, people are just sitting on the couch expecting, you know, this to come and that to come. And while you're waiting for all that success, you simply had to wait tables, push grocery carts. This is the reality of life. As we wrap up today, Gerald Celente, any other closing topics?
Well, the thing on the economy, there's no question about it. Again, when you look at oil prices, decline they're under, and when you look at property prices around the world dropping, and the reality of interest rates going up, when interest rates go up, the economy goes down. We're forecasting, and that's what's going to happen. They're going to have to raise interest rates. However, having said that, when the economy starts going down, when interest rates start going up, they're going to come up with a new scheme to juice the economy with more fake money. And when they do that, that's when you're going to see gold prices take off.
You know, history is our guide here. Everyone thinks that precious metals rally is over for good, but think about it. Back in the 70s, things didn't really take off for the precious metals until inflation was more evident. And that's when the Fed was forced to ratchet up rates to levels never seen before in the United States.
That's right. People forgot that.
So people are thinking, well, the Fed can just raise rates. Well, they forget at what cost. What was the cost? How about the 1980s was one of the tougher work environment and employment situations for quite some time. Who's going to have the courage to do that now? We don't have the political wherewithal to say, hey, you know what? We're going to have to fight inflation, folks. So instead of increasing your limits on your debit cards, your EBT cards, what we're going to do is we're going to take most of your jobs away by ratcheting rates up so high that businesses close up shop. Nobody's going to do it.
And not only that, you're looking at private mergers and acquisition activity now is at the highest level it's been since 2007. And the only reason that's happening is because all the cheap money they're getting.
The banks are sitting on an enormous amount of money, and they have nothing to do except toss it at things like stocks or buy their own shares back. So it's well said. All right, Gerald Celente, we want to thank you for your time today, and I'd like to give you a chance to tell people more about the Trends Journal and any other projects you're working on.
Yeah, the Trends Journal. Matter of fact, just today we launched the Trends Monthly. So besides the quarterly, we're putting out a monthly. We, of course, every evening, weekday evening, we do Trends in the News, about a 20-minute news show. And we're having another conference in mid-October, History Before It Happens conference. We just had one in August 1st, and we had people from all over the world, from Japan, from Australia, from Switzerland, as far away as from Honolulu, Alaska, to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to New York City. So we're really doing a lot. We're having the meetings here in Colonial Kingston, New York, at the 1774 Academy. Couldn't be more appropriate. So we're doing a lot here at the Trends Journal.
Sounds great. We're going to look forward to having you back on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Lots of discussion is taking place right now regarding the big Fed meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen is spotlighting in her speech what she calls the phenomenon of pent-up wage deflation. She says many firms faced significant constraints in lowering compensation during the recession and the earlier part of what I call the alleged recovery because of downward nominal wage rigidity, which is defined as the inability or unwillingness on the part of firms to cut nominal wages. Firms may not have lowered compensation much during what I will call the Depression, but they did cut the fat, the meat, and the bone from their organizations. They closed offices and entire divisions. People were fired, or should I say their contracts were non-renewed, or they were right-sized. And demographically, it was often older workers in their 50s who concurrently lost a significant portion of their retirement savings and pensions, if not their homes. So maybe those that did remain in the workforce didn't see a rapid escalation of their wages, but they have experienced inflation in what it cost them to survive, even if those inflation numbers aren't reflected in the official statistics. Yellen went on to say, to the extent that firms faced limits in reducing real and nominal wages when the labor market was exceptionally weak, they may find that now they do not need to raise wages to attract qualified workers. As a result, wages might rise relatively slowly as the market strengthens. She then said, if pent-up wage deflation is holding down wage growth, the current, very moderate wage growth could be a misleading signal of the degree of remaining slack. And here's the kicker. She said wages could begin to rise at a noticeably more rapid pace once pent-up wage deflation has been absorbed. I believe wages, coupled with gold and silver, are the three barometers that are the indicators of inflation. The canaries in the coal mine that the Fed hates to report on positively. What is significant about the emphasis Yellen is putting on pent-up wage deflation is that this language pattern is going to rapidly become part of the national and global vocabulary. The Fed is trying to prepare us, at least for a while, to disregard wage inflation as representing true inflation. Pent-up wage deflation will be presented and interpreted by talking heads as nothing more than catch-up inflation to get us back to where we should have been in terms of what should have been normal wage appreciation. But make no mistake about it, the fact that Yellen is preparing us to disregard the coming wage inflation indicates a concern the Fed can no longer hide. Now they will try to convince us the inflation we are about to see is okay, and that the man behind the curtain is our friend. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000 meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Lots of discussion is taking place right now regarding the big Fed meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen is spotlighting in her speech what she calls the phenomenon of pent-up wage deflation. She says many firms faced significant constraints in lowering compensation during the recession and the earlier part of what I call the alleged recovery because of downward nominal wage rigidity, which is defined as the inability or unwillingness on the part of firms to cut nominal wages. Firms may not have lowered compensation much during what I will call the Depression, but they did cut the fat, the meat, and the bone from their organizations. They closed offices and entire divisions. People were fired, or should I say their contracts were non-renewed, or they were right-sized. And demographically, it was often older workers in their 50s who concurrently lost a significant portion of their retirement savings and pensions, if not their homes. So maybe those that did remain in the workforce didn't see a rapid escalation of their wages, but they have experienced inflation in what it cost them to survive, even if those inflation numbers aren't reflected in the official statistics. Yellen went on to say, to the extent that firms faced limits in reducing real and nominal wages when the labor market was exceptionally weak, they may find that now they do not need to raise wages to attract qualified workers. As a result, wages might rise relatively slowly as the market strengthens. She then said, if pent-up wage deflation is holding down wage growth, the current, very moderate wage growth could be a misleading signal of the degree of remaining slack. And here's the kicker. She said wages could begin to rise at a noticeably more rapid pace once pent-up wage deflation has been absorbed. I believe wages, coupled with gold and silver, are the three barometers that are the indicators of inflation. The canaries in the coal mine that the Fed hates to report on positively. What is significant about the emphasis Yellen is putting on pent-up wage deflation is that this language pattern is going to rapidly become part of the national and global vocabulary. The Fed is trying to prepare us, at least for a while, to disregard wage inflation as representing true inflation. Pent-up wage deflation will be presented and interpreted by talking heads as nothing more than catch-up inflation to get us back to where we should have been in terms of what should have been normal wage appreciation. But make no mistake about it. The fact that Yellen is preparing us to disregard the coming wage inflation indicates a concern the Fed can no longer hide. Now they will try to convince us the inflation we are about to see is okay, and that the man behind the curtain is our friend. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.